Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Welcome into Pickaxe and Roll, brought to you by Superbook Sports. I'm your host, Ryan Blackburn, at NBA Blackburn on Twitter. We're part of the Mile High Sports Podcast Network, and I am joined by a very special guest. He is part of the Mile High Sports family as well, doing some podcast coordination, as well as some other projects, I think, that have not yet come to light, but I think are going to be very exciting. It is the King of Thornton himself, Jeff Morton, King of Thornton, at jmorton78 on Twitter. Jeff, how are you, sir?
Used to be King of Thornton on Twitter, and I was the idiot who changed that and then lost the ability to reclaim King of Thornton. So
that is it was perhaps the worst decision you have ever made in your life.
I think so. There's certain things you can't come back from, and apparently this is the one of them.
I'm excited to have you on because I do think that one of the things that we have both discussed as part of kind of my transition to Mile High Sports, but also just sort of the general future of what we like the sports world and the entertainment world to look like is for those to kind of be able to be discussed together. Given how similar a lot of these aspects are, I think when you boil it down to it, I was a sport management major actually in college, so this is where my learning actually applies. But this is like the sports entertainments, all of like if you're doing concerts, if you're doing productions of some sort, it really is all the same thing, and it's just like different versions of the same thing, and so I feel like in a lot of ways, it generates the same reaction. It generates the same emotions in various fashions that sports will. So we are always very tied closely to the entertainment world. I do want to leave that for the second half of our podcast. But for the first half, I'm going to ask you. I know you're commenting a little bit on Summer League. And I was just wanting to get your general thoughts on how you thought the rookies performed and how the Nuggets performed at Summer League so far.
Yeah, my analysis of Summer League is simply this. People were concerned about the offense at Summer League, and then were not acknowledging that the Denver Nuggets assembled a squad that was almost entirely made up of defense-first players, other than maybe Colin Gillespie. This is a squad that was offensively challenged from the beginning, and it's like I don't know. Whenever I look at the analysis of Summer League, I am always shocked at how much people read into it, because I have seen. I mean, Summer League became more of a prominent thing in the early 2000s.
Right.
But it really picked up steam in the late 2000s into the early 2010s. Warren Legarry, George Karl's old agent, was the guy who basically created Summer League in Vegas and really has the market cornered. So like when people get credentialed, you're not going through the NBA, you're going through the people who run Summer League.
Right.
And I've always been surprised at the people who go to Summer League and take or then watch Summer League and take it seriously, insofar as you can't tell anything. These are glorified scrimmages. You're just not seeing the best basketball out there. And I've my go-to line, as I'm sure you've seen, Ryan, over the years, is Nicholas Skidishvili was the MVP of the 2003 Summer League. And I always leave it at that. And what I'm telling people is that do not take this shit seriously. It is not worth your time. Wait till we get to preseason before we start to analyze these people. But to answer your question about the rookies, they all look like rookies to me. I mean, yeah. They're rookies amongst rookies and second year players and all this stuff at Summer League. Christian Brown, and I've got to get used to saying Brown and not Braun. Christian Brown couldn't hit the broadside of a barn. Peyton Watson looked like a project. Gillespie looked like he had it together, and Kamigate looked like he needed some serious seasoning. We knew all that going into Summer League, and absolutely nothing changed. So I'm like, what, how, I mean, maybe I should throw it back to you. What was your takeaway? Because you, at least you pay more attention to this thing. What was your takeaway?
Well, pay attention, I think, is definitely giving me a little bit too much credit here, but I did watch the games. I did kind of was appalled at the overall level at some points, but I think my general feel was that it has just a different level of impact than what Bones' Summer League was last year. His level of Summer League and what he showed, what he was really emphasizing at that point, I do think it was tangible and I do think it was valuable. I think it really set the stage for him where he was successful at Summer League. He was successful in preseason, and though it took him a while to kind of get adjusted to the NBA and his new role, he eventually found a role that really suited him, and he was successful at the NBA. So there are players, I think, that you, when you see them succeed, then it's a good indication of things to come. And then I also think about Zeke Nagy in that same Summer League and how he was horrible. He was just absolutely horrible, not defensively, but offensively. Right. During that stretch. And you think about that, and you think about Christian Brown, you think about Peyton Watson, and some of these guys, like, there are certain traits that you're hoping that they show. With Christian Brown, I would have hoped that he would have hit some more shots, or at least looked more comfortable hitting some shots and taking some shots, because it looked like he was throwing up a medicine ball out there at times. But it's tough. Like you said, it's only Summer League. These are very brief takeaways and very brief sample sizes and whatnot. And I did come away with a feeling about the same as I did on draft night.
Well, our boss here at Mile High Sports, his wife is an alum of KU, and she could probably tell you that Christian Brown, his percentages are very much hot and cold. And so you average out hot and cold. It reminds me of Vashawn Leonard. Vashawn Leonard would hit everything and then hit nothing. And it was just like that. And they call them streaky shooters. And Christian Brown seems very much to me like a streaky shooter. The problem with 3-and-D guys is that they depend almost exclusively on how much energy they are producing on the defensive end and how that affects their shots. And that is why the good ones don't necessarily have a tremendously high percentage of threes, but they're good enough. And all I'm looking for from Christian Brown is to be good enough. He's not here to be Mr. Offense. He's here to be another defender primarily, who can contribute offense. So I think that part is where I'm not like, that's why I shrugged. I'm like, this is exactly who I thought he was. So I'm not looking for that. He played good defense. And I'm like, that's okay. That's exactly what I see. He's doing exactly the things that I see. Watson is the one where I still don't know what the Nuggets were doing. And what the Summer League did with this one was kind of prove my opinion that maybe they should have taken him at 31, not 30, to where he could have that second round contract. because he's guaranteed a roster spot now, and he is definitely a project. And so that part is, if I'm going to take anything away secondarily from Summer League, it's that. It's like Hayden Watson had one good game and four pretty sketchy games. And he looked like a guy who is offensively challenged to the extreme. And I'm wondering if, like, the Nuggets couldn't have picked him up in the second round. And that's just with the thought that keeps coming back to my head, man, just keeps coming back.
Yeah, it's like they bought a pick to go get Ismail Kamigate in the second round at 46. I know, having spoken to Gordon Gross about this, our mutual friend, he always views it as Kamigate is the 30th pick and Peyton Watson was the 46th pick, but they had to get Peyton Watson at 30. And I'm not surprised that they went and got a first-round pick in order to get somebody like him, because the four-year contract, I do think, actually matters for him specifically. You got him on the cheapest possible first-round deal that you could get, and you get four guaranteed years, which means that you have kind of a long runway to allow him to develop, because in theory, he makes sense as a guy that can develop into the player that you're hoping for, which I think is just this 6'8" defensive do-it-all, do-enough offensively type, which, if he gets there, that's a really valuable piece. There are very few players in the NBA that can kind of replicate that. But like you said, he is just so far away that it's I start thinking, like, okay, Bruno Caboclo was 2 years away from being 2 years away. This sort of feels the same in terms of, okay, yeah, 2 years away from being 2 years away. We're probably not going to see the best of Peyton Watson until his second contract.
I want to throw this out there. You brought up having a long runway. What concerns me is the roster spot. I don't care about the contract, because the second round contracts can be extended. Those guys are really at the mercy of the organization. I'm not really concerned about that sort of potential. The roster spot is what bugs me, because the guaranteed roster spot is, say, like, if they wanted to bring up someone who was kicking ass unexpectedly, but they've got a guy who's taken up a roster spot who is a project to potentially be a project, which leads to maybe a good player, and down the road, if you've got that progression, that is what bugs me. It's like the guy is going to be occupying a roster spot. And in a win now window, and people have heard me say this over and over on the Morecast, but in a win now window, your moves are finite. You got to, everything can hinge on a player, on the even on the back end, because injuries happen, stuff happens. And I just don't see that pick as necessary. And that is my dispute with it. And nothing, and what the point I'm making is, nothing I saw in Summer League dissuaded me from that. You know,
and it's not surprising. Like, everybody, I think, knew that he was going to be a project. The Nuggets have advertised him as a project as certainly as they possibly could. So we're just going to have to take their word for it at this point. That, hey, if you do have the vision, then that's great. If this doesn't pan out, then it's not going to be, like, it's probably going to be at least 2 years before we can really say for sure. But yeah, it's going to be very fascinating to think about what it looks like and how he operates, how the Nuggets kind of operate with him. So should be fascinating. But I do want to now transition into the other part of the Nuggets discussion that we're having. This, to me, feels like a championship year. Mm-hmm. It feels like the prerequisite for that has been met, which is, everybody's talking about championship. They've made championship caliber moves, and they have the championship caliber cast of characters that you had the down years for a little bit, and now you're kind of getting back to this place where it starts to feel fun again. Do you feel that? Do you sense that?
I think, let me answer that by saying, I think they improved the starting lineup, and that was important. I don't think they necessarily added The interesting thing about this is that I think as long as this Nuggets starting lineup is out there, they're going to be great. I am less confident in what's behind them. And that with any championship team, with as much money as the Nuggets have devoted to the top end, obviously you're not going to have a lot of room to make the roster stacked, basically. So I think my questions before I get to a championship feel, I need to know how the backup center situation is going to shake out. I think that's number one. And number two, how much they're relying on Bones being this backup point guard, and if they have a plan B for Bones, if he's more of a two, you know. So other than that, I guess what I'm saying is I need those two questions answered, because I think they did the right thing with the starting lineup. And this is they've improved their win totals, barring health, with what they added on the starting lineup. The other aspect is I just don't know the other questions. And, you know, maybe you could answer, but, you know, look, obviously they did not sign DeAndre Jordan to have him play. This was, I think, a locker room thing. That's just my interpretation. I think Jeff Green really wanted him on the roster, right, and lobbied hard to get him on the roster. And I think you're not solving your backup center issue with him, but are you solving it with Vlatko Chanchar or Zeke Nnaji? You know, I don't know. And maybe, Nate, once again, I'm going to rely on you on this. Do you think that I'm making too big a deal of the backup center position?
I don't think you're making too big of a deal of it. I think that that's – if you're coming into the season with a checklist of items, that was probably the last one in terms of the standard rotation. You had to improve the starting lineup. You had to make sure that you had some bench defense, and they did that. And then the backup center and figuring out what to do with that was probably third on that checklist. They did the first two as well as they possibly could. I really do believe that KCP was probably the best player they could trade for reasonably.
And you like Bruce Brown.
And I really like Bruce Brown. I think he's going to be very good. Like, one of the reasons why is he's going to be probably a 25 to 30 minute per game player in the playoffs, and he can play with just about everybody. And that utility, I think, makes things easier for not just when you have an injury, but when you're trying to sit guys out and come up with these rotations. It's really, really easy to just plug Bruce Brown in as the third option on a lot of these rotations when Jokic or Murray is sitting. But what I will say is I think you hit it, that this roster, as you've mentioned, is so skewed top-heavy, to the point where it's never been this top-heavy in Denver's history, I don't think. It's at least very possible that that's the case.
Yeah.
Back in the 2018-19 season, if you remember, they had Monte Morris, they had Mason Plumlee, they had Malik Beasley coming off the bench. I think they had Trey Lyles coming off the bench at that point as well. But there were just a lot of, like, there was a lot of talent on the bench, and it was one of Denver's biggest assets was that they always won those bench minutes, and their starting lineup didn't have to be as good in order for them to win games. They still won 54 games that way. Now, rather than have like the 15th best first player first option and the 20th best second option, they have the first best first option or second best first option in the entire NBA. And they have probably, in terms of second options, I think Murray's top 10. Porter's probably top 10 in terms of third options in the NBA. And so you start to really skew that talent like that, and you're going to leave some gaps on the back end. But to your point, Bones Highland, a lot of pressure on him. I've been thinking about this a lot ever since they kind of reconfigured the bench the way that they did.
Yeah.
There is so little usage on that bench outside of Bones. You have Bones, Bruce Brown, who's like a 18% usage guy, if that. You have Zeke Najee, who's around the same. You have Jeff Green, who's even lower than that. And you have Davon Reed, who's about the same as Jeff Green. And when you combine all those together, you're supposed to get 100. That's what you're supposed to do, is get 100% usage. Bones is going to have like a 35% usage in order to do that, which is like a Russell Westbrook-esque, a James Harden-esque usage. It's higher than Nikola Jokic. He might have a higher usage than Nikola Jokic does, which is insane to me. And and when you like, they're going to have to stagger, but because you have to stagger, like, that's actually going to change your starting lineup, and you can't play that lineup as often. So there's a lot to think about. There's a lot of juggling to do, and it's just going to be tough to see it until it happens.
Well, my concern with the center thing was primarily because the Nuggets, just until they got Boogie last year, the center situation was terrible. It was awful. And I don't know if they can count on a backup five being Zeke Najee and Vlatko Chanchar. I just don't know if that is something that you can rely on. But aside from that, the point you're making about Bones is interesting, because obviously he's never been in this position before, but where else is the offense going to be coming from? Because we're also relying on Michael Malone staggering, which is not something that he is exemplary at. So if he's committed to staggering, then it's not going to be as big of a deal. Maybe Jamal plays with the second unit. Maybe Mike plays with the second unit. There's ways that they can adjust that. And if he's able to do it, and if he wants to stagger, that would probably cover up a lot of the offensive issues on the second unit. And maybe Bones's usage goes down. And, you know, and to clarify something here, I'm not ragging on Nuggets here, because, you know, I think they did the most important thing, which was shoring up their starting lineup. That is number one, and that is by far the first thing they needed to do. And moving on from Will Barton was a big part of that. And the cost of moving on from Will was giving up Monte Morris. And it is what it is. But you moved on and you upgraded, which is by far the most important thing. So the Nuggets will be a better team this year. I have zero doubt about this. They'll be probably a much better team this year, just by that. I have little concerns, and sometimes little concerns can turn into big concerns, but that's where the way my brain works. So whatever.
No, I'm with you. Like, I asked this on Twitter, I asked this to people, what is the one word that comes to mind when they think about what are the roadblocks for the Nuggets to win a championship this year? And I do think that it's an important question. By far the most common one was injuries. It was health, it was injuries. That's what people are most concerned about. And I think that's a very fair, realistic concern, where you have Jamal Murray coming off of an ACL tear. He hasn't played. He's supposed to be fully healthy. They're probably going to ramp him up just a little bit. But even when you account for Murray being back fully healthy and Porter having a fully healthy season, from a back perspective, a twisted ankle is still going to do a lot of the same things with how top-heavy the rotation is. Like, how are you going to survive some of those minutes where, let's say, Murray has to sit out a game, but he was the guy that was staggering with the second unit? Do you now stagger Porter? Do you just play Bones by himself? How does it work? All of these questions, I think, are very fair. And that is definitely the most common thing where people are like, okay, yeah, let's kind of hold up the brakes just a little bit here. The Nuggets, right, I think, have to prove that they are going to be healthy.
100%. That is the ultimate decider, obviously, is the injuries. Because injuries did them in last year, let's be honest with you. As soon as PJ Dozier went down, you knew it was going to go not what you wanted to. Because
it was
by
a
that
sinking
point,
ship. Like, at that point, for whatever reason, because you had Jokic go down with his, I think it was a thumb injury at that point. And so he missed six games. And in the midst of that, PJ Dozier tears his ACL just out of nowhere. And you're just left with thinking, man, Now you're not, you don't have Murray, you don't have Porter, you don't have Jokic, and now you don't even have PJ freaking Dozier. Right. you're just dropping like flies. It was a cursed season last year. Denver can't have that happen again.
No. Well, and usually cursed seasons be followed up with relatively healthy seasons. That's the pattern in the NBA is that these things are cyclical, and they're not as random as people say they are. Every team cycles through years where they get the worst end of the injury bug. And it's just the nature of the wear and tear of the league. And where the Nuggets have, I think, an advantage here is people have overcomplicated the Michael Porter Jr. thing. Either he can play or he can't. I mean, that is really the only thing you need to answer with Michael Porter Jr. Either he can play or he can't. Either he's physically able to play or he can't. That's it. It's a simple, simple thing. There's no other question with Michael Porter Jr. because there's no doubt that he wants to be out there. And that's why he probably had a setback last year, because he really wanted to be out there. So I'm not worried about that with Mike. Either he can play or he can't. I do have some issues, and I'm lingering questions about Jamal. That's me. I have questions about how mentally ready he's able to play. And that's me looking at it from a 10,000 foot perspective. I have no information at all on Jamal. I just based on the way they're talking already about him not playing much, doesn't really concern me, because that's typical for coming back from an ACL. But a lot of it seemed to be like, make sure Jamal's mentally ready to come back. And I think that's the biggest hurdle. And sometimes that's the most complicated hurdle. And if Jamal is able to come back, and I don't care about his physical state, because Jamal's played through injuries plenty. I worry about the mental state. And if he's never suffered through anything like this in his life. So if he's mentally able to come back, there is where the Nuggets hinge point is. It's not Mike. It's Jamal. And if Jamal is mentally able to be fully engaged and there, then the Nuggets will be a borderline special team next year.
It's going to be fascinating to see. That's definitely the most common roadblock, I think, that people propped up. It was the health of those two guys specifically. The bench, as you mentioned, definitely a big roadblock. The other three that I do want to mention here that get the most run, the first one is defense. And I'm not really surprised by that, given where Denver was. I do think that they added the requisite pieces in order to just get better. And we will see whether that actually happens or not. We'll see whether these guys can make an immediate impact, or if it's just a hope that they can impact things in the playoffs a little bit more. We'll see. But that's one.
Yeah.
The second one, I think, is Bones readiness. And maybe that's kind of tied in with the bench. But I do think that there's sort of an intrinsic belief that he's going to make a leap, whether it's a Jordan Poole leap or a Tyrese Maxey leap or something akin to that from year one to year two. The hope is that he leaps. If he doesn't, then I think you're left in a situation where, man, we put a lot of eggs in this basket, and now there really isn't another solution, as I think you mentioned earlier.
Yeah, that's where I'm wondering. They signed Gillespie to a two-way. So I'm wondering if that is the hedge right there, and see if they have, maybe we need a Monte Morris-esque type behind Bones, because Bones is, it's interesting they're putting that much trust in him for as much volume shooting as he could do and have zero conscience as far as that goes. Sometimes it's good to have a Monte Morris type saying like, okay, I got to get this ball to someone else over here. Like, I'm trying to envision he and Mike playing in the same second unit actually now. And I'm hoping it's smooth.
I think there are some good things that they could do. And one of the things that you hope for in a situation like that is you surround them with other capable defenders like a Bruce Brown, like a Christian Brown, a Davon Reed, and a Zeke Nagy. And you just kind of hope that those guys in that situation can carry the defense while Bones and MPJ do their thing offensively. Everybody's wanted Mike to kind of step up in that regard and really be that first option in those sort of situations. So this is the right time to do it, and we'll see if he's ready for it. But the last one is Michael Malone. For whatever reason, I heard a lot of people talking about Michael Malone and whether they could actually, I guess, whether the Nuggets could kind of get over the hump with him. And I think that they can. Like, I don't see that as a massive roadblock, but he also hasn't coached beyond the Western Conference Finals yet, and all of those different levels are going to provide their own challenges. And when I mean coach, I mean head coaching. It's all just going to provide unique challenges, and it's not just going to be for Nikola Jokic and Jamal Murray and Michael Porter Jr. It's also going to be for Michael Malone and what he has to do in order to get the most out of his team. And sometimes it's going to mean pushing on some buttons that people are going to be upset when you push them.
Yeah. I'll look at it this way. Regardless of what people think of Michael Malone, he has this year. He has this year to prove that he is a championship coach. Now, in a lot of ways, that's unfair because the NBA is a players' league. So if you have the requisite players playing on a string within themselves and they know what to do, it's the players that will dictate who wins and loses. It's rarely the coach in the NBA. The coach where he excels is rotations. And Malone has been both good and terrible at it. And it's hard to get a read on him as a coach when he's all over the map with his rotations. And sometimes it's to the detriment because it's the remnant. I'll just put it to this way. It's the remnant of coaching a rebuilding team. There's a reason rebuilding coaches don't often make it to championship coaches, because there is a whole different set of considerations that you need, from players, multi-million-dollar players with egos who are stars, as it is to the other end where you're a rebuilding team, and it's almost like you're a college coach then. So you can really have the control and all this stuff. Michael Malone, if he's going to be a better coach this year, has to give up control a lot. He is going to have to learn that he cannot be micromanaging everything. And this is his year to prove it. I'm glad you brought that up, because that is the most fascinating thing for me this year, is if Malone can adapt to giving up that kind of control and moving towards a more of a CEO role like George Karl had his last years, or, I mean, even Phil Jackson would let Tex Winter and Jim Clemens and all these other coaches coach for him in those ways. Greg Popovich with he has tons of assistant coaches like who have been like that through the years. Brett Brown and Mike Budenholzer, both prime examples of that. That is where I'm looking at it. People always accuse me, and there's going to be people listening to this like, "Ah, she's bashing Malone again." I don't know.
Hey, I brought it up. It's okay.
And I think he deserves a year, complete year, to prove that he can be that next level coach. To me, he's a good coach. I need to see if he can loosen the grip in order to become a great coach.
Over the course of the last month, 2 months or so, in when he's spoken to the media, spoken about what the Nuggets need, it's been about defense. It's been about committing. But he's also had these lines here or there where it's not just about the new additions. It's about getting the same players to commit defensively. It's about finding better ways to defend, and that applies to the players, coaches, etc. And I do think that this is a great opportunity for him to prove himself. They did a nice job. I'm not sure who was the catalyst behind it other than Jokic saying that he likes to play at the level of the screen. But when they made that change, when they made that transition, that's when they finally had their defensive leap. It wasn't when they added Paul Millsap. It was when they added that level of aggressive defense, or at least mixed it in. Now teams have kind of figured it out. That was 2018-19. That was 2018-19, 2019-20, 2021, 21-22. Mm-hmm. So it's been 4 years. And now you have to come with the next thing. How do you defend with Nikola Jokic? How do you defend with Michael Porter Jr.? How are these perimeter-based teams going to attack you? And how can you head them off at the pass? That is his next challenge. And I do think that it's one that he can solve, that the Nuggets can solve. But it's going to take time. It's going to take effort. It's going to take a tremendous amount of buy-in, I think, from everybody in terms of orchestrating and kind of applying this new scheme. And whether they use this new scheme immediately, he hasn't really specified that immediately, but I sort of get the sense that they're going to have to defend in different ways than they were. And they're going to try it early in the regular season, in the preseason, whatever. And they're going to have to commit to it, because I remember when Milwaukee did that, when they were experimenting with switching, 2021 season, that is when they won the title. And that was the reason why they won the title, was because they were able to kind of bolster what they already did well. The Nuggets need to do the same.
Yeah. Schematic issues aside, defense, I've never thought great offensive players need to be great defensive players. I think they need to just know what they're doing. That's it. Because you don't want them spoiling their offense with their defense. My philosophy on that is pretty proven throughout the years. Two-way players are rare. Two-way players are rare. That's why they are superstars. They are rare. And all you need, like Kawhi Leonard's don't grow on trees, but you see the wear and tear he puts on his body from working so hard on both ends of the floor, right? And my philosophy has always been, you need a guy, this goes for Jamal, this goes for Mike, this goes for all the players on who are questionable defensively. You just need to be competent and know where to go. Mike has struggled with knowing where to go. The desire is there. The synapses aren't firing in the way that they need to. And some of that comes with repetition. And unfortunately for Mike, he hasn't had any repetition. He's played 100 games, something like that. And
yeah, it's like 150 or so.
Yeah. And it's not a lot of ton of games in 5 years, 4 years, you know? So it's you're counting on someone who just really hasn't played. He's missed two full seasons, basically. So if they're able to get to the point where Mike isn't being incompetent, that's all you need. In this expectation, you need him to turn into the reincarnation of Bruce Bowen is complete nonsense. You do not need that. You just need him to be just semi-competent. That's it. And maybe he can get to that point. And that's my hope this year, is that he can just progress to the competency range rather than excelling at defense.
Let's take a break. We are in a really great Nuggets conversation here. We are going to transition into some entertainment conversation after the break. But first, summer is here. There's no better time to make your first bet with Superbook Sports. Along with his usual vast betting menu, Superbook already has a lineup for every pro football game this fall. Plus, when you make your first deposit on the Superbook app or sign up at superbook.com, they will match 100% of your money up to $500. It's never too early to start thinking about football at Superbook Sports. Place your bet. Start winning today. Visit superbook.com for terms and conditions. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-522-4700. We're back. Pickaxe and Roll, Ryan Blackburn here. Thank you so much, everybody, for tuning in. I'm joined by the legend himself, the King of Thornton, Jeff Morton. Jeff, I think you've done a great job over the course of your Nuggets tenure, your Nuggets media tenure, by making it not just about basketball. And it's very important, I think. It's something that I haven't necessarily learned and applied as well as I probably should, but sticking to sports is bad in all aspects. I think we can agree about that.
Yes.
But for just your general life, sticking to sports is also really bad. It's important to be holistic. It's important to be a fully formed human being. So
right.
I kind of spoke about this at the end of the last podcast. I think it's just important for everybody to be able to discuss. It's important for me to be able to discuss on a podcast and talk about some of my other interests in life. And one of those interests is what people watch, what people are streaming. Like the common man and woman, they love
salt of the earth.
The salt of the earth. We love to be entertained in front of a screen. That's our goal in life most of the time, and that'll manifest, I think, in movies and TV shows. For me, it's video games. Even like I now do audiobooks a lot of the time. I think I've listened to like 45 audiobooks over the course of the last 3 years or so. It's been great. I've really enjoyed my time there. And I'm a big fantasy guy. I'm a big fiction person who likes to be transported into another world entirely. And I honestly think that a lot of people sort of share that sentiment for a variety of things. But real quick, what was the first memory of a book or a movie that you had where you were just fully immersed and you were fully just invested in whatever it was?
The Empire Strikes Back in 1983. My dad took us to see it. You could argue E.T. E.T. played for a long time. My parents divorced in 1982. And so obviously, whichever parent gets the kids that weekend, they spoil the kid. So, you know, that they get to go see a movie. And we made our dad take us to see E.T. about 50 billion times to the point. To the point where I think he's just like the movie was memorized by him. He could recite the lines. Next year was Empire Strikes Back. Both of those movies for kids. I mean, I'm not a Star Wars fan. I have seen none. I repeat, none of the new movies. None of them. I haven't even seen any of the TV shows. Nothing. I haven't devoted time to it. It doesn't interest me. But in 1983, I was a big fan of Ewoks. So there you go.
I love it. I can't believe you wouldn't support our mutual friend Trey Mitchell. That's just so unfortunate. That's insane. I just watched the Obi-Wan Kenobi series. That was really good. We're not gonna talk about that one, but one of the first memories that I have is Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban. I remember the theater. I remember where I was. And I remember the nightmares that I had for the next month and a half of the Dementors, where they have the gross looking hand that kind of wraps around the door. And it was a very visceral reaction that I had to something like that. It was the first major memory that I have of just being fully immersed in a medium like that. And I just think that concept is so fascinating because you get this way in sports too, where you're at the fourth quarter, you're in a very particular situation where it is just captivating, and you have no idea what else is going on around you. It is just you and what's going on right in front of your face. And I think there's just something fascinating about that.
Well, in 1988, and I remember this vividly. I was stay at a friend's house all the time, and we would watch horror movies. Because I said, as you do when you're that age. And I remember he brought over the movie Hellraiser, which was a child should not be watching. 10 or 11 years old at that time. And just I should not have been watching that movie. But it was really a basically lifelong love of the horror genre. John Carpenter is my favorite director of all time. I love John Carpenter, and he has influenced everything. And we're going to be talking about a show that he specifically very much influenced here later. But if I'm going to talk about a genre of film, horror is what I'm responded most to. But I like every movie. I watch movies constantly. I'm always watching movies.
It's fun. Like I think some of it is, I think a lot of people want to find the next great immersion, where you're finding that next thing. And it was the Star Wars back in the day, where you're at Empire Strikes Back, and that was just one of the most emotionally traumatizing moments for people, where they learned that Darth Vader, and spoiler alert everybody, Darth Vader is Luke's father. And so that's, I think about those kinds of moments. Jaws is, of course, up there like that. But
wait, just, hold on a sec. Did I say Empire Strikes Back and not Return of the Jedi?
Yeah. Because
I meant to say Return of the Jedi.
Oh, good. Well, yeah, no wonder you said Ewoks. I was beginning to say
it. Like, I meant to say, oh my God, there's going to be people screaming at this podcast. Don't come for me, nerds. Do not come for me. I'm an old man.
I am an old man.
Do not come for me. I meant Return of the Jedi. Okay. Anyway, continue.
Yeah, that whole I am your father revealed did not happen in Return of the Jedi. That's so funny. Oh, man. But no, like, I think it's fun to be immersed in something like that. And I think a lot of it is escapism. A lot of it is people go and this is one of the reasons why I think sports has been politicized in a lot of different ways. A lot of people would go just to watch the game, and they're just looking to take their mind off of what's going on in the world right now. That's kind of the narrative that you get on both sides of the coin in that particular way. But some of it is just, I think people like to root for a story. Some people like to root for something better. Some people like to root for something worse, which that is a fascinating image in and of itself. And we're going to talk about some of these series where there's some pretty gruesome and graphic things that happened in the three series that I wanted to mention with you here. Mm-hmm. The first one is one that you turned me on to as we kind of prep for this podcast, The Old Man. The next is Stranger Things, and the next is The Boys. All three of those, I think, are just fascinating. But which one do you want to start with?
Let's start with Stranger Things, because there's a story with that, particularly this last season. You know that article I wrote last week?
Yes, I do. And I meant to talk to you previously before the podcast if you wanted to talk about the article at all.
We can bring it up. That's the reason I wrote it. I wrote this article about how I lost the ability to communicate with my colleagues because I'm the only gay person who covers the Nuggets. And it occurred to me after the Jokic no homo incident that removing the incident, that I couldn't communicate or talk to anyone I was with about any sort of level of feeling I was having. And it just completely killed my joy of covering the Nuggets. 100% is exactly what happened. But the catalyst for this was the character of Will Byers in season 4 of Stranger Things, and how they nuanced him and made him very clearly gay and very clearly in love with his best friend. And it made me realize that's the way it was back then. This is the 80s. It's just the way things were. And it was a very accurate portrayal. Long story short, it made me look back at my life and think about critically about things that I have done and things that I have approached in my life and the ways I'm, because it was such a reflection of me. I had to do the introspective thing. I had to go down that road. That my dad used to say, introspection is the mother of depression. And
great.
Which is anyway, that's my dad. So I'm like, I had to do it. I had to go through it. And some of that was the catalyst for that article, is me unpacking a big part of me that people were like wondering why I was so disconnected from Nuggets coverage. Well, that's why. Since 2018, I've been just basically a husk. And it was started by this, what I saw was a mirror reflection of a dorky 80s kid. I wasn't into Dungeons and Dragons or anything, but I was, just a nerd. I love music to this day. That music drives me.
Sure.
And I love finding new bands, but same thing as movies. And we're going to be talking about TV shows and stuff like that. But that was me. And it made me go look at that. So it's amazing how a show that is basically geared, it's like a Steven Spielberg doing Stephen King, Steven Spielberg doing John Carpenter. That is exactly what it is. It's like the kids in danger, but there's the wholesomeness of Steven Spielberg and like the Goonies, like a Richard Donner movie, like the Goonies, those things. Like, and that's another one, by the way, when I was a kid, the Goonies, that really immersed me in movie making. But that's it. And so Stranger, it's amazing how, and that's the first time, and I don't know if you've ever had this, Ryan, that's the first time I've ever seen a TV series or a movie or anything like that portray something that was reflective of something that I could identify with. I managed to go through my entire life without really having that sort of thing happen. And then I reached the jolly old age of 44 and suddenly I'm getting a crisis thrown at me just in my middle age. I wasn't ready for this.
Well, honestly, I thought that's why you're wanting me to watch The Old Man, so you could have me kind of relate to what you're feeling consistently. No, I
don't do that when I'm drinking water. That almost went everywhere.
I saw a funny tweet. Stephen King actually tweeted this after watching Stranger Things season 4, episode 8. And he's like, I'm kind of scared to watch the next episode, which coming from Stephen King, that's a pretty high praise for sure.
Right.
And so it's just fascinating. Like, I remember watching Will kind of go through that and was just in pain watching him during that situation, thinking, man, because there are so many kind of nuanced things in this, in that series, that really kind of portray the 80s in that way and how drastically different it is from 2022. And it's, mm-hmm. it's not so far back that you can't, like, you can look through a looking glass and then see, okay, it kind of looks like what our world looks like right now. But there are so many, and like that just seemed, it was so visceral. And so I'm not surprised that you had that reaction. I'd have to think about some other shows where I had some sort of reaction, kind of flashbulb moment where that was me in that situation. I'm not sure if I've had that yet. So maybe I'll have to wait until 44 too.
You know, well, hopefully it won't take that long. I was thinking about it today, in fact, and I'm like, it's not specifically necessarily this. You know, obviously, it's a fantasy show that features a place called the Upside Down. This is not something that we're going to be able to really extrapolate out to reality, but it is firmly and very firmly, rigidly based in the 80s. It is staked its flag in the 80s. And one of the things I actually did a podcast about this. One of the things I love about it is the portrayal of the Will Byers character. It would have been very scary and very dangerous for him to say he's gay. It would have been extremely bad. And I actually like the fact that they're doing that. I like the fact that they're portraying it true to the way it was, because I'll be honest with you. This is a show that is marketed towards a family. So it's basically all ages. It's an all ages audience for this thing. And it would be very easy for them to give them the Gen Z payoff, which is everyone has the emotional affirmation. And if they remain true to the 80s, it's not going to come. And I don't know if people are prepared for that sort of thing right now, because people's brains are not trained for that. We need the emotional satisfaction of having a resolution, or at the very least having a satisfactory resolution. And I don't think we're going to get that. And I think people need to kind of mentally prepare for that possibility. I think that's perfectly fine. But I understand if you're like a 17 to 22 year old watching this and you're trained on different shows that give you that emotional payoff, I can understand why that would upset you.
I did like, and you said it earlier, that it is definitely more geared towards families. Some of that, like, I think it's healthy to show a character like Will in kind of a family show style context, because I think it opens up just how difficult it was for a lot of people and kind of gives a lot of information with that. You'll see that with a variety of other shows, I think, that sort of layer in those traits that I think there are certain segments of the community that it was really, really difficult for them at that time. And I'm sure you relate to that extensively. A show that is not related to family values, I think, is The Boys. Mm-hmm. That's definitely one where immediately in that show, and if you haven't watched the show, if you haven't watched the series at all, then I implore you that if you're okay with gore, you should watch it. Like, I know that sounds awful, but like it is one of those shows that you will think about the world a little bit differently. Yeah. And then the superhero tie style world a little bit differently having watched this show.
It's a cynical show. It is extremely cynical. It is, you could tell, this is like, and I told my friend John Reedy this, that it is a show like it was tailored towards Gen Xers, because there's just a cutting edge of cynicism and nihilism, because nihilist is extremely nihilistic show cloaked in sarcastic humor. Like everything, it is just like, it's hard. If I was going to ever describe this show, I couldn't adequately do it, because it's superheroes who are all extremely flawed, extremely flawed. They are superheroes only in might, but they're not in virtue. And it is a combination of that aspect and you're talking about the gore, the opening scene of the third season. There's something that happens that I was not prepared for that. Okay. And it set the tone for the rest of the season. I am not going to spoil it, but it set the tone for the rest of the season, because that was taking everything from the first two seasons. That was just like 20 times farther.
Now, Jeff hasn't watched the entirety of season three, so people don't spoil it for him. But even in season one, like the opening scene of the show is immediately thrusting you into this cold reality of what a superhero world could look like.
Yeah.
And like, I think I could spoil it to people now. Huey's girlfriend at the time dies in the most disgusting, awful way possible, at the hands of a superhero. And it was just, it had to be traumatic. It had to be just, for Huey, but like, it was just traumatic for the audience too, because you immediately are thrown into this where, you know, okay, this is what this show is going to be like. It is drastically different from Stranger Things, drastically different from anything that I've ever watched before. And yet I love it because I think it walks this line between disturbing, discomfort, and hilarity. And it's on that threshold and sometimes past that threshold a little bit too much. But if you don't push your audience, and like comedians talk about this all the time, but if you don't push that line, then you're never going to get a genuine laugh.
Yeah, well, I don't think I've ever seen a show like it. And it really does a good job of skewering hero worship, superhero worship specifically.
Yeah.
And there is no doubt that this is a critique of Marvel and a critique of all of the culture that surrounds superhero movies that everyone has to like now. And it is almost like they're like trying to, and we're talking about mirrors from the when we're talking about Stranger Things, and this is kind of a holding up a mirror to society, like, hey, this is like the way this could go. And obviously superheroes don't exist, but we worship them in our culture, the movies that they're constantly producing in The Boys, and the TV shows, and the merchandising, and all of that stuff. Is it not only a critique of superhero worship, but a critique of consumerism? Everything is being consumed. These superheroes are loved because they can buy their merch, you know?
Yeah. It's fascinating the way they've layered in all of this sarcastic satire that is just, it's meant to directly it goes right up against the MCU, like you said. It goes right up against there's a lot of current society things that I think are generally portrayed that way as well. Mm-hmm. But it's awesome. Like, I think people should definitely watch that one. And one that you turned me on to, as I mentioned before, was The Old Man. Yeah. And that was one that I had never heard of before. It's definitely kind of like, I think Stranger Things, I think, is like that A tier popularity. The Boys is like B tier popularity, where it's still pretty popular, but like, it's not to the level of some of these blockbusters. The Old Man is like C tier or D tier in terms of what people have heard. And yet I think it might be the best series of them all.
Oh, it's so good. Have you talked to Gordon about The Old Man yet?
He has no idea that I've been watching it.
Okay. Because it is. And let me give you a story. First time I ever saw Jeff Bridges in something was Star in 1984, which is, if you haven't seen Starman, it is a very, very good movie that he got an Oscar nominated for. He plays an alien in it who comes to Earth, and it turns into a road movie and stuff like that. It's another John Carpenter film, actually. And that's how he has always been in my head. You know, Jeff Bridges has always been the guy that I first saw in Starman. So when you look at The Old Man, this is a guy who's pretty fairly along in age. I mean, he's the same age as my dad, and he's doing stuff that you're not expecting. And it is a fascinating movie, TV show, fascinating TV show. Just the way, and John Lithgow is in it too. And John Lithgow played it. It's both of them, both John Lithgow and Jeff Bridges are just brilliant, absolutely brilliant in the whole thing. And it really is a character study of the two men. And it is, I just love the way they did it. I mean, oh my God, you've only seen the first three, right?
Yeah, I'm 3 out of 6 episodes into it. So I haven't gone all the way through, but I'm loving what I'm seeing so far. The part that I really appreciated for them was the way that they framed the beginning and how they started this, where they're talking about his health issues, where he was talking about, okay, there's some things that he's seeing. He's thinking about, is he going crazy? Is he going insane? And then it turns out that's not the truth, or at least from my perspective, sitting in the middle of this series. So we'll just have to wait and see whether I'm crazy or not. But this one was it was the one that was the most real, and followed by The Boys, and then followed by Stranger Things, I think, of course. Although, like, they all have these tropes that I think people can really attach themselves to, and everything that they can really pull from. Like you mentioned in Stranger Things, the ability to kind of see things through Will's eyes. And for The Boys, I kind of see things through Huey's eyes in a lot of ways. Like,
right.
Oh my God, this there's so many crazy things that are going on around me. This is unbelievably stupid.
Yeah.
and like the old man, I think is the kind of culmination of that, kind of moving towards that, where it's so real, and that was really what stood out to me.
I mean, you know, that show was in production, and then Jeff Bridges announced that he had lymphoma, so they put it on hiatus, and then the pandemic hit, and then he got COVID while he was going through chemo, I think, and then I think he came back to finish it once he got through the lymphoma. And it's like, that man is tough. And it's like, and it comes across in the show. And I think it was renewed for a second season, so this story will continue, but I don't want to spoil it, because if I go too far on it, you'll know. And you'll know what it's about. But I'll say is that Jeff Bridges, it's a physical performance. There are several fight scenes in it. But it is about a man who is in a web of intrigue, I guess is the best way to put it. And it is so well done. Honorable mention to Dark Winds, another show that I mentioned to you. It is a Native American noir set in the 70s. And it is really good. Really, really, really good. It's the characters are just so good. And I really appreciate, I really appreciate Native American culture. And they, the 99% of the cast is Native American. And okay. It's filmed in New Mexico, but it's set in Kayenta, the Navajo reservation up in northern Arizona. And I respond to that because I've been through the res. You drive through the res in order to get to Phoenix if you're driving from Western Colorado, and if you drive through Denver, you go through the eastern edge of the res, and it's a place that you have to see to believe, and it's fascinating, and I can go on and on about that show. It is so good. It's noir, murder mystery, slash Native American mysticism, and it's all combined together, and it's really good.
Well, I will definitely check it out. I think we're fortunate at this point that there's so much great content. And I had talked to you about saying that I wanted to do some stuff like this, that I wanted to talk about some streaming and whatnot and some of the shows that we've been watching. And I was wondering if we were going to kind of overlap on any of the things that we liked. And yet we overlapped on so many. And there's just a world of other things that we could potentially go into that I think we may try to go into later, either later in the summer or into the fall or something like that. But I love these kinds of conversations because I feel like it is a different layer to the general sports talk that we usually have.
All right. Absolutely. And it's fun. And we used to do this with Tim Connolly when he was on our podcast. In fact, the last time I had him on, Nate and I had him on together, he actually double booked. he ended up doing, I think it was, they were BSN, or was it the DNVR pod or something like that? Or Locked On. It was Locked On Nuggets with Adam. And he sent a text to Nate and I saying, I hope we're going to be talking about TVs and movies, because I got a whole bunch that I want to talk to you about. Like, okay. So we devoted the last 45 minutes of the show to just talking about TV shows.
I love it.
Fire That's Festival, fantastic. I think he was on about. Yeah.
Of course he was. That's awesome. Well, Jeff, you've been fantastic. As always, I love talking to you. It's been a pleasure, of course. You got anything coming up that people should keep an eye out for?
On Gen X Show, I've got another installment of my Rolling Stone series. The last one was with Steve Gorman from the Black Crowes. He came on to talk to me about Sticky Fingers. So the next one's going to be at Exile on Main Street. And I'm sure I'll have some sort of interview coming up on CSG. I got to find the motivation to talk about something on Nuggets related. Maybe I'll have you on and we'll do it.
Oh, God. What the hell are we going to talk about? I have no idea. This is why I'm talking about entertainment right now, Jeff. Come on now. Right. Well, I'm obviously more than happy to come on. We'll see how that goes. But for now, everybody, that is going to do it for this episode of Pickaxe and Roll, brought to you by Superbook Sports. Thank you so much, everybody, for tuning in. I'll probably be back on Friday. I'm not sure what I'm going to talk about yet, but I'll probably talk about something. Thank you so much, everybody, for tuning in. We'll talk to you guys very soon.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.